Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Good afternoon, everybody. There are a great many of you here. Thank you so much for being here. It's a real pleasure to be here. To begin, I'd like to acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Gadigal people and we pay our respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. My name is Ben Doherty. I'm a journalist on The Guardian newspaper and it's my great pleasure this afternoon to be your moderator. My job beyond this introduction is essentially to get out of the way of what will be an extraordinary panel, a brilliant collection of minds from whom we are going to hear on the breathtakingly broad subject of displacement. And we live, in many ways, in an age of displacement. Human beings are, by instinct, sort of peripatetic creatures. To move, to go somewhere else is a fundamentally human thing to do. But there has never been a period in history, in human history, when more people have been forcibly displaced from the place they call home than today. Even before the pandemic, there were 80 million people forcibly, unwillingly displaced from their homes by war, by violence, by religious or ethnic persecution, and by the ravages of climate change. And the outflow of people from their homes has not ceased because of the virus. We see massive movements of people through Central America fleeing the chaotic collapse of their countries. We see people forced from their homes by natural disasters in the Pacific. And the pandemic itself has caused new forms of displacement. Right now, as we speak, thousands of citizens and residents of this country cannot return home because of travel restrictions. They are displaced too. And we see, not yet on the big screen, but about to, we see a manifestation of displacement here with us today. Behrouz Bouchani joins us by video link this afternoon because despite 8 years of being displaced, despite this country legally owing him protection, he is still not allowed to set foot in this country. We're joined here by Behrouz and needs no introduction, a Kurdish-Iranian writer, journalist, filmmaker. His memoir, No Friend But the Mountains, Writing from Manus Prison, was written in secrecy while he was being held in the Manus Island Detention Centre in Papua New Guinea. He also shot, somehow, in and directed a film, Chauka, Tell Us the Time, from detention. And you thought you didn't get anything done during lockdown. We are joined as well by Zoe Holman, a journalist and writer whose reporting, essays and poetry have appeared all over the world and is the author of Where the Water Ends, Seeking Refuge in Fortress Europe. At the end, we have Zaki Hadari, who's the 2020 Australian Human Rights Commission Human Rights Hero. And just a general all-around hero, New South Wales International Student of the Year. He fled Afghanistan aged 17 after his father was disappeared by the Taliban. And the Taliban murdered his brother. His mother and six siblings are still living in Afghanistan in a country that still cannot find peace. And Adama Kamara is the newly appointed Deputy Chief Executive of the Refugee Council of Australia, the national peak body for people seeking asylum, refugees, and the organisations and individuals who support them. Adama has 15 years' experience in refugee services, as well as personal and family experience of seeking asylum and supporting newly arrived refugees from our home country of Sierra Leone. Can I ask you to welcome our panel this afternoon? I'm going to start with the very clear and obvious and unhappy manifestation of displacement that we have before us right in this room. And Behrouz, I'd like to come to you first. As a person who has known persecution and displacement for so long, I'd like to ask you about home. What does home mean to you? Where do you find it? And how do you rebuild it once it's been taken from you?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me tonight. So I think that is a key question. It's a very important question for the refugees and migrants people. But I think if we have a very simple definition of home, is I look at it as a nest. So home is a place that you feel safe there. When you go at work and come back at evening, so you feel peace in your home. So that is a very simple, basic definition of home. But in terms of the refugees, so I think it's quite different because the refugees struggle to reach to a place, to find a place and call it as a home. So that is the very basic definition about home. And so the question is that about the refugees in, especially in Australia, that how these people, when they released from detention, they call Australia as a home. When the refugees are in a prison camp and they tortured by the system for 8 years, 7 years, 9 years. And when they release them, we expect that they call Australia as a home. I think that never happened because they already traumatized by the system for many years. So I think that is a very key question. That, and now we have so lots of researchers, lots of people are working in this field to make a situation and a space for the refugees, to migrants, to contribute to the society. And they actually accept Australia, I'm particularly talking about Australia, as a home. But we have that system too. So I think that doesn't happen. That never happened, that the refugees accept Australia as a home. So that is a very key question. So we should think about it.
Adam, Baruz mentioned there a sense of contribution. I suppose when we talk about displacement, how critical is it that refugee voices are central to that discussion?
I think it has to be the focal point of the discussions because people with lived experience are the best to talk about what the solutions are. And often that's not the case. So I think often it's seen as, you know, a problem, and people aren't seen as people, as humans who need, and their capacities are not recognised in a positive sense. It's seen as a negative. So I think that in the refugees discourse, it's got to look at people with lived experience, their voices being heard, and the solutions that they're proposing being central to the discussion. It's quite important. It's in other movements they call it nothing about us without us. And I think it's the same when it comes to the refugee rights movement. Anything to do with refugee policy, we've got to be at the heart of that discussion. So that what Baruz is talking about is how can about home, about making people feel welcome, about acknowledging what is missing, but also what the aspirations are of people and making sure that actually happens. It's quite important.
It sounds like you're suggesting as well that it's important that people's immigration status is not the sort of definitional element of them, that you're looking beyond, that you're looking past that to the broader person, to, as you say, their skills and abilities and desires.
Absolutely. And I think that in the current, in the discourse, if you see someone as, it's the refugee issues or crisis or problem, you're forgetting the human. And I think it's humans that we're talking about here, humans who haven't, and it's people who have, everyone has the same right to education, to employment, to be reunited with family, all those things that we all take for granted. And I think if you see people as human, the language changes and the approach changes and how you, and what we want to do about it changes. So, yeah, I think it's definitely at the heart of it.
Zaki, there are very sort of obvious manifestations of displacement. We see people fleeing over borders to seeking sanctuary. We see offshore detention centres and those sorts of things. But there are also hidden forms of displacement that's almost invisible within our community. I'd like you to talk a little bit about that sort of silent, unseen displacement that exists in Australia today, right now, that is largely unknown.
Absolutely. We have kept refugees in Australia for over 8 years. Refugees who has been granted refugee status, we acknowledge that they are refugees like myself. They cannot go back to their home country, but we keep them displaced in this country, in our community. They don't have a place to call permanent home. Like myself, my visa runs out in September, and I have to reprove myself again that I'm a refugee. I have to go through the whole cycle again, from submitting an application, going to interview, prove myself that I'm a refugee, I cannot go back to my country. And why should we do that again if we have been granted refugee status? So that's not part of the issue again. We have kept people displaced away from their family and loved ones for 9 years, and some people more than 10 years. Their kids grown up with their mom or dad overseas. The parents who have been here stuck in the system haven't seen their kids for that long time. They can't bring them here, so they don't have a place to call home. A place that they call home is their country, which they cannot go back. They stuck here, it's not home for them. The Australian immigration system never welcomed them, welcomed us. Instead, there was a layer of punishment that was added on and on and on. First, being released in the community with no work right, no access to formal education, signing a contract which they named code of behavior, that you can't talk to media, you can't tell people who you are and what's going on in the community. All those, it's sort of, you know, dehumanizing refugees, but also not welcoming them in a system way. But also, it stopped them from calling Australia a permanent home or a home. We don't have a place to call home. We can't bring our family. We've been living from our family for over 10 years. A home is a place that you go in to see your kids, to see your loved ones, to have this feeling of safety. When you walk in, you have your family. But instead, what we have is we go home to an empty house, worry about our families that are stuck in a war zone country like Afghanistan, calling our families before we go to sleep, not just to see how they're going, but to check in if they're surviving. So we don't have a place to call home. We never had that.
You came to this country by boat. You were a child when you arrived here. It was an extraordinarily difficult journey. You're now going to be asked to go back and relive that and talk about that. In the meantime, in your country, Australian troops, US troops are leaving. Your mother, your siblings are there, worried about the future of that country. Can you give me a little insight into what it's like to live with that constantly, I imagine?
Afghanistan has been in a war for 40 years. International forces went in to bring peace, to fight against Taliban. They clearly failed, but they don't acknowledge it. Instead, they're bringing that regime on table saying, we will recognize you to the world. We recognize your regime. We want you to come back and control Afghanistan, which that means to Hazaras. I am from a Hazara ethnic minority, which Taliban don't accept our religion. We're Shia Muslim. They clearly said Shias are not recognized in our government, which then automatically persecute us based on our religion, our ethnicity, which they have done. When Taliban come to power, they kill thousands of Hazaras. So for me, physically, I'm safe here, but mentally, I'm thinking all about those times the Taliban were in Afghanistan, because my siblings, my family, my loved ones are still on the ground. They're living with the fear of when the Taliban will come, and we're going to witness another civil war or another genocide by Taliban. So now all those things that's going in our head, not just me, but I know fathers, moms, that they have their families over there and they can't do anything. It's like your family is burning inside of a window. You see them burning alive, but you can't touch them. You can't rescue them. So to put it in a picture, it's like that. Your family is sort of dying in front of you, in front of your eyes, but you can't do anything to protect them because, again, we can't bring them here. We're not an Australian permanent resident. We haven't given a permanent protection. We are not an Australian citizen. So again, we have been living here for 8 to 10 years, working full-time, having a job, but still, we can't call Australia a permanent home. So we can't risk our family.
Zoe, I'm going to read to you from your book, which may or may not make you feel awkward. Zoe has written an extraordinary book, Where the Water Ends, Seeking Refuge in Fortress Europe. She writes about an extraordinary man called Tamir, who's Palestinian and has I'm not going to give too much away, an incredibly Kafkaesque experience seeking asylum in Europe. And there's an extraordinary quote from him. He says, "I used to believe in all that stuff in textbooks about human rights and the Nobel Peace Prize. I had seen how well they treated stray dogs in Norway, putting clothes and little shoes on them in the snow, and I thought surely they could help me. But it is just an illusion. rights only apply to those people who they accept as human, and I was not one of them. It is my dream once in life just to be normal in the airport, to not be stopped, to not be put in a separate line, to not be looked at like I am something strange, something different. Now, many of us in this room will have Australian passports, which are an incredibly powerful passport, and yes, we haven't been able to travel because of the pandemic and those sorts of things, but going to another country is a thing that happens for so many of us almost unthinkingly. But for so many people around the world, this is what happens, that the idea that being pulled out of lines to be something separate, something different, something unwelcome, is the experience of travel all the time. Can you reflect on that and Tamir's experience?
Yeah, I mean, you've sort of explained it well yourself. I think though so many of us take this sense of belonging and mobility for granted, there are so many people, you know, as many people in this room will also know, that exist outside that category. And to exist outside that category of having some form of, you know, legal document or passport is in many ways to exist outside a kind of category of humanity, I think, of recognised sort of status. And it also reminds me of an anecdote of another character who I document in the book that I think is quite powerful. And this was a young Syrian man who came and sought asylum in, arrived in Greece shortly before the borders closed in 2016. And that was the time when people could travel relatively freely into the rest of the EU. And he arrived in Greece, and in order to travel more swiftly into the north of the EU, he bought a fake Norwegian passport, I believe it was. And while he was waiting to travel on that passport in Athens, he hung out for a few days, and he talks about how he was going to some nightclubs and kind of befriended one of the Greek security guards who was working at the hotel. And he said to them, "Oh, I'm a businessman visiting from Oslo." And the man was, you know, treated them with respect, and they'd hang out and have beers and, you know, kind of really welcomed him to Greece. And, you know, he talked with great sadness about this experience, actually, because he felt at some moments he just wanted to turn around and say to him, "Actually, I'm just a Syrian like these millions of people who are coming through the country." But he knew that that would totally shift his status. And in fact, he told me how when he did finally fly from the airport from Athens to Oslo, he boarded and he went through customs, and the Greek customs official said to him, "Oh, you know, enjoy your trip." And he walks on a bit and he turns around and he says, "Actually, I'm a Syrian," you know, and continued walking. And that was kind of just this real tension and, I guess, liminality he felt between these two categories of belonging, you know, within Europe and also then this kind of outside, you know, really marginalised category. So I think it's, yeah, it's a very precarious existence, but one that's, you know, really defining for people.
Beryl, you and I have spoken about this a number of times, about the dehumanising elements of detention, and particularly of indefinite detention. I'm wondering if you can reflect on that, the way that Zoe described people being treated as other, as outside, as not belonging, as something outside humanity. I think was the phrase Zoe used. Is that something that resonates from you with you from what you recall of your time on Manus Island?
Yeah, so I think the main part of this system and this, I mean, the policy towards the refugees is to dehumanize the refugees, to criminalize the refugees, and introduce the refugees as a terrorist, a rapist, a drug dealers, and all of this. This negative propaganda. So, but in Manus Island, so we have lots of examples and many stories that how someone like Peter Dutton, and even before that, Scott Morrison, when he was an immigration minister, we have lots of examples and stories that how they just used the media and created this mess and also dehumanized the refugees. So that's why, so of course it was really difficult for us when we were in Manus Island to actually challenge this, and always because the you know, that is my problem with journalism language, is that the media actually rely on the official sources. So in Manus Island it was really difficult to challenge that because we didn't have this platform. And in terms of my work, so we know each other for many years, actually. So for the audience, that I know Ben since, I think, 7 years ago. And we we're working together for actually many years. So, I mean, you know all of these stories that how it's difficult really to challenge the system. So, but what we did in Manus Island, we always try to introduce the refugees just as a human, you know? And even with in terms of the with the humanitarian organizations, I think, and the advocates, their perspective is quite wrong towards the refugees because they always try to romanticize the refugees and introduce the refugees as an angel. But we are not angel, just we want to that people see us as a human. So I know that you know, it's really difficult. So it is a new perspective towards the refugees. And that's why I believe that the refugees and people with the refugee background, they should be a part of the main discourse. And we should create a space for the refugees to actually create a knowledge and add to this knowledge that we have to through their lived experience. You know, the refugees have a special perspective because they look at the society in a different way, you know. So in Australia, if we talk about Australia, you see, and even about the detention, how these refugees think about politics from inside the prison camp, how these refugees think about that society, how they, these people think about the principles like such as humanity from inside the prison camp and in the community in Australia. So because they, I think the refugees are marginalized among the marginalized people. You know, they become marginalized twice. And that's why I think it's very important that we create a space for the refugees to challenge this system and this propaganda.
Zoe, Beruz mentioned there the sort of use of journalistic language and those sorts of things. And one of the themes, and it was even mentioned in the pricey for our discussion this afternoon, the word crisis. And the word crisis is often used, particularly in the European context, to sort of describe migration across the Mediterranean. And crisis is a word that's sort of beloved of newspaper headline writers. One, it's very short. Two, it's sort of urgent and energetic. But it also implies sort of something temporary, something that will be solved, something that will pass. But I wonder whether we need to sort of consider, if we're now living in this age of the sort of massive, sustained and increasing displacement, the world needs to confront this displacement as not this crisis that will pass, but a sort of embedded reality of our current life. And I wonder, if it is a crisis, what sort of crisis is it? Is it a migration crisis or is it a political crisis?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, the notion of a crisis, I think, as we've seen, is one that's really been used excessively in many ways in the media, but one that, as I sort of discussed throughout my book, that I think we need to call into question a lot of the time. The first reason for that, I would say, is that, you know, as it was kind of applied in the EU context, the idea of a crisis suggests something of a massive and unusual scale, whereas, okay, of course, what happened in 2015, 2016 in the EU, where we had around 1.5 million people arrive, was something relatively unprecedented in the EU. However, relative to the scale of displacement in the world and in the region in particular, what the EU confronted was actually quite small. I mean, particularly, for example, compared to Turkey, where you have 3 to 4 million Syrian refugees or refugees in general, or Lebanon, which has the highest per capita number of Syrian refugees. So it does tend to kind of inflate what the EU experienced, whereas I think the EU in total hosts around 10% of the world's refugees. So it's actually quite a minor fraction. And so it tends to warp both in sort of time and scale, what is happening there. But I think another real important thing to consider with the use of crisis is that the term crisis somehow implies something that was sudden or accidental or chaotic and unmanageable.
Or unpredicted.
Like, unpredictable, yep. Exactly, like that it sprung up on the EU. Whereas, in fact, okay, we have had arrivals to the EU over decades. And also, I mean, 5 to 6 years on from 2015, 2016, which was the purported crisis, we have still a dire circumstance, particularly in the Aegean. And I think we really have to consider what is happening there, not as a crisis, as something that was, you know, haphazard and unmanageable, but something that's actually the intentional outcome of a project and a policy. You know, it's more of a manufactured crisis. And a lot of people that I spoke to throughout the book kind of commented on this idea of a crisis, that something can be put forth by politicians or the media and capitalized on, you know, politically or economically. So I think it's really important to keep in mind that what is actually happening in Europe, though it might be framed as a crisis, is, you know, we can see it as intentional almost outcome of policy measures that are being taken there.
If we stay on Europe for a moment, Australia has been, and I'm hesitant to use the word, a sort of pioneer, for want of a better term, promoting policies like offshore processing, boat in interdictions and boat turnbacks and those sort of things. These are gaining currency in other parts of the world. We see the UK Home Secretary considering, you know, Ascension Island and Gibraltar as offshore processing centres. Can you give us a sense of, I suppose, similarities and differences between the European situation and the Australian, both politically and in reality? What do you see as being the key similarities, but also the things that are going to make that situation very different?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly since 2016, which is when the EU kind of signed the EU-Turkey deal, which really focused on, rather than welcoming or receiving refugees into Europe, really focused on a strategy of externalisation, returning refugees to Turkey, massive investment in border security. And from that time in particular, we've seen politicians across the EU, including the UK and Greece, directly cite the Australian system as something that is something that Europe should be considering adopting as an approach. I think one of the Greek politicians even said, yeah, we should be putting people on remote desert islands and locking them up, and that will teach them not to come. So I think in terms of that emphasis in, yeah, offshore detention, outsourcing to third-party countries like Turkey and North Africa, it's really, has a huge resonance with the Australian system. And also in terms of discourse, I think we've seen the same kind of replication of this idea of, oh, our policies aimed at ending people smuggling, ending deaths at sea, and this kind of fallacious premises for really hard border security. And also, I think, importantly, on a human level, the outcomes, I think, have been also really mirroring what we've seen in Australia. So, I mean, the first time I went to Moria Camp, which is the first camp on Lesbos, as soon as I saw it, I thought, Baxter Detention Centre, Woomera, you know, really, on a physical level, there was such a resemblance. And I think for the people who are detained in those facilities as well, we've seen, you know, mental health crises, depression. So it's the same kind of human corollary of keeping people in transit and detention and really unbearable circumstances. I mean, one distinction I think that is important, I think, and I kind of take heart from, is that, you know, unlike Australia, the EU is a different geography, and it's a geography in which it's much more difficult, I think, to really physically separate people. So there's always going to be people arriving to the European continent by whatever means, and thereby having interactions with European society. And I think, you know, in Greece in particular, to witness what came out of those interactions in terms of solidarity and support and different kinds of social evolution and discussions, I found really heartening, and it made me reflect on, you know, what has, for the most part, an opportunity that's been denied in Australia just by virtue of, you know, how extreme our border policy has been in really aggregating asylum seekers and the population. So that was something that struck me as a difference there.
One of the other things, Adama, that Behrouz mentioned, he said it's very hard to fight the system, but people are finding a way. I'm really interested to hear about Operation Not Forgotten. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, Operation Not Forgotten is a project that Refugee Council is working on with two organisations in Canada, so Mosaic and Adds Up. And I was about to swear, but I promised I wouldn't swear. It's a way to say a few to the government and the policies, in a sense, because I think what it is a group of volunteers got together and said, look, we need to find durable solutions for people who are stuck in PNG and Nauru. They have a right to have a life and to continue to have the normal things that we do, that we all have. And so what it is basically the Canadian government has a private sponsorship program which allows organisations to sponsor people, refugees, to live in Canada. And the organisation, in partnership with Refugee Council, is actually fundraising for that. And at the moment, we've got, I think it's over 130 people have been granted visas from PNG and Nauru to actually be resettled in Canada, because they need durable solutions, and durable solutions is all about making sure, you know, people can continue to live their lives, have an education, have security, be reunited with family members, and enjoy a normal life that everybody else has a right to. So Operation Forgotten is really, I guess, our way to circumvent the policies that have been so destructive, and offer people durable solutions. So, and I think that that campaign is actually supported by everyday people. People who are probably sitting in this room have donated to that campaign and have supported that because they believe that everyone needs, you know, people need protection and need opportunity to live a life and be reunited with family members. So the cost for something like that is, I think it's about just under $20,000 for an adult. And then for a family of four is about $30,000. So the fundraising that's been happening is actually, what happens is, you know, is a person who's in Nauru or PNG, the application that's submitted is for themselves and their family members as well. So it's seen them as a family unit, which is really important because they've been separated from family for however many years. And this whole this private sponsorship program allows that family reunion, which is so important.
But it does seem an extraordinary situation that we have people with recognised refugee claims who are under the aegis of a wealthy liberal democracy that has the capacity to resettle refugees, that does resettle refugees, yet people are having, I'm assuming, cake stalls to raise money to send people to the other side of the world, to Canada, to accept places.
It doesn't make any sense. And I think, though, that I think we are inspired by the resilience. You know, my family's come from a refugee background, and I know that that resilience that you have, like you say, the need for survival, and the, like, we can't give up, we've got to continue because, you know, if I make it, then I can support the others to make it. So I think that resilience and that determination has inspired us, and we continue to inspire that. And I think also the number of people who've supported this Operation Not Forgotten is significant. Figures I've just gone from the top of my head, but it's we're looking at over $1 million that has been supported by individuals probably sitting in this room that have supported this project. So I think when we talk about, you know, refugee policy in Australia and the impact it's having, it's quite difficult, difficult fact. It's quite difficult. It's quite negative. But at the same time, as individuals, we can say, well, what can I do? And this is one of the things that people can do. I mean, you can go and lobby your politician, but you can also support a cause like this because you know there's a tangible outcome for somebody who's been separated from their family members, that there's a chance for them to be reunited in another country that actually is welcoming them and wants them to be there and will support them to thrive and to live. And that's, I think, bringing the human back to it, and also as an individual, what can I do to support people? Yeah.
I want to come to you again, Zaki. One of the words that Adama used there was resilience. And you work assisting asylum seekers and refugees with employment, and those and many of those people have come with sort of extraordinary qualifications and are looking to contribute, are looking to be part of this community. Can you tell me about the work you do there?
Yeah, so I work as an employment support worker at JRS, Jesuit Refugee Service. My work is to sit with people seeking asylum, to see what work they have done back in your home country, and how can we help to find them a meaningful job, you know? And often you come across people that they never had that conversation because the system put them in, dehumanized them in so many levels that they didn't have the chance to sit with someone to have that conversation in a human level, to ask them, what work do you want to do? What is it for you to get up in the morning and to look forward to go and spend your day as an employment? So I think employment is the main factor for people that are facing challenges with refugee background or people seeking asylum. It is a challenge, but I think we are so grateful at JRS and many other charity organizations. And that's what I do is because people seeking asylum or on bridging visas, they have no support from the government or state government. They're basically most of the time relying on charities just to survive. So sometimes it's hard to see them, but also it's also powerful to see them how resilient they are. You know, to get up every morning and go out and seek for employment, or seek where to go and how to survive. So there's the resilience in people that are still surviving, and we work with people that have been in this country for over 8 years because the system is so complicated. Once your visa is rejected by the immigration, you have to take it to Federal Circuit Court, then to Federal High Court. And that amount of time, you have no support. In most cases, people wouldn't have even work right. Or they do have work right, but again, they don't have any medical support. So the system, once if you're off from that process of getting your refugee status granted, if you get off from that system, if you go through the federal court and all this complicated process, you have no support. And you often see people become homeless. And they have gone through so much in their home country on the way to getting to Australia. Mentally, they are not very, I can't blame them, they are not very stable. Because they are living under stress of when their claim will be processed properly, or it might never be processed. In their head, they're thinking that when we will be deported back to their home country. So living under those stresses, depressed person, it's really hard to sort of even get out and find employment. But you know, you see the resilience in them, and they come out and seek for a job.
That sense of contribution, that sense of purpose is so important. I remember when Baruz and I were working together on a lot of stories when he was on Manus Island, and people had asked me, how's Baruz doing? And everybody who was in detention in that place had an extraordinary range of emotion. It's an incredibly difficult place to live and exist. But Baruz was able to manage the peaks and troughs, I think, far better than many people, because he had this sense of purpose. And Baruz, you and I have spoken about this. He had a very strong sense of identity in that place, and a mission almost. His job was to be there and to bear witness and to give testimony as to what was happening in Manus Island Detention Centre. And I think that gave Baruz a purpose, you know, a reason to get out of bed in the morning. And I think that was hugely vital to you, Baruz. And we've talked since about that sense of contribution, about for people who have been displaced, being allowed to contribute to their new communities is vital for overcoming that sense of displacement. You know, home is much more than a roof over your head and food on the table. You need to feel part of the community you've moved, that you're now a part of. You need to feel a purpose there.
Yeah, I think Zach, you mentioned a very good point. So what he's doing, actually, they are creating a space for the refugees to feel that they are a part of the society. And that is, you cannot feel that without contribution. So this contribution, it means that the refugees do something that they are really interested in, and they are willing to do that, and they have a skill. So they should do that. I would like to share a story with you, actually, to compare New Zealand and Australia. You know, Australia and New Zealand, that how these two systems are different. You know, in Australia, even when you released in the community, and even when you are working, if you be allowed to work, the refugees always feel that the system is chasing them. The system control them. And sometimes that control is just by sending a letter to the refugees. And that system, I mean, that is a part of, that is my understanding of Australia mentality. It used to systematic torture. Even they do that with the people, with their own citizens who during the COVID, you know, I hear many stories from many people in the quarantines that, okay, we are staying in this hotel, we accepted that, but why do you torture us? You know, I mean, that is a part of Australian mentality, I think. But in New Zealand, when you seek asylum, so you have a lawyer and you just deal with the lawyer. They don't come to, you don't feel pressure by the system. I think that is very different. So that contribution that we are talking about, even by finding a job, doesn't happen. You know, we should create the peace, the space that these people really be themselves, you know. I think that is important. So I forgot about my story. I wanted to share a story that when I came to New Zealand, what happened with me with the Australian citizens when I met them, yeah, which is related to the contribution. So I think we don't have time.
No, Burroughs, I'm going to invite anybody who would like to ask a question to raise their hand and come to them and come up. I think someone will come and fetch you. In the meantime, Burroughs, I'd like to hear your story, and I'd also like you to move a little bit to the left, because at the moment we've got half of you on the screen, and you're a handsome man.
Yeah,
all of you. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, sorry. I think, so of course I have experience in Manus Island, but I have been in New Zealand for more than a year. So I have a different understanding now, different perspective. When I arrived in New Zealand, after a week actually, I was invited to be a part of a panel in an art exhibition in Wellington. And after the exhibition, we had, so the organizers invited us to have a dinner. So there were four Kiwis. And in the same time, there was an Australian artist that she was a part of the, that exhibition, that gallery. And it was very interesting. For the first time, I met an Australian person out of Manus Island. You know, in a different, you know, both of us, we were outsider. And it was very interesting that I felt close to that person, and that made me angry. I say, why that happened? Why should I have this connection with an Australian citizen, you know? And I think that was, I think about that a lot. And I think that feeling comes from the contribution. Because for many years, I had this opportunity to write about politics in Australia, about the refugees, and just to make Australia as a better place, you know, to live, you know. And it was, I think that feeling comes from my contribution towards the culture or politics in Australia. And since that time, I really think about this a lot, you know, that how this is a key concept that we, if really we want to, that the refugees feel Australia or other countries as a home and feel they have a, they are a part of this society, they belong to this society, I think we should create a space for them to contribute. But that is not only finding a job, you know, that is the, but that thing that Zaki mentioned, something that the refugees really are willing to that and are interested to do that. I think that is very important. So just that came from through my experience.
You have made an immense contribution to this country, Burroughs. I don't mind what you're, if they'll give you a visa or not, you are one of us, absolutely. You've made an enormous contribution to this country. We have time for, we might have time for one or two questions. Very quickly, can I invite someone to ask a question?
My question is directed at a member of my tribe, who's Bhutani, but really anybody can answer. Quite rightly, Burroughs, and justifiably, you often criticise Australian leaders for their appalling and shameful treatment of refugees and asylum seekers. Yet, they are not responsible for your being a displaced person. They are not responsible for your becoming a refugee or an asylum seeker. To my way of thinking, it is the Kurdish leaders who cannot talk to each other that are responsible for your becoming a refugee and asylum seeker. So my question is to you, Why don't you write anything about Kurdish leaders?
Yeah, I think so there is a two matter. So now we are talking about Australia, you know. But of course, if you follow me on Twitter, you see that how people attack me. And that is my experience on Twitter. That even, you know, I have been attacked by many people in Australia. Of course, I got support, but many people, many trolls in Australia, but I cannot compare it with the large, you know, a huge attack that always get from the community, the people in Iran. Probably 90% of the people in Twitter attack me and they hate me. And even in the Kurdish community, once I did a tweet, just one tweet about the Nachirwan Barzani, he's the prime minister of Kurdistan in the Iraqi part. And even I got a death threat. You know, that is my life in, you know, in politics. And so always I criticize that. And I do that. And that's why I am always under pressure. So even we really, I know that people who follow me on Twitter, they know I cannot compare this. Just I did a tweet about the Afghan refugees. 1,000 people. I haven't experienced something like that, you know? So actually my, just once I wrote that if we compare the trolls in Australia with the trolls in Iran and in Kurdistan, that region, actually the trolls in Australia are more creative in the way, yeah, they attack. They are more creative and even they are sometimes funny. But those trolls in Iran, in Kurdistan, are really are very cruel people. And the way they are, so why did they do that? Because I speak. I talk about the minorities and that's why. So I'm not, of course, in the way I talk about Australia, I talk about those countries too. So that is my life, always being attacked and criticized by people.
Thank you, Behrouz. I'm very sorry. Our time is up this afternoon, but thank you. The issue of an independent Kurdistan will have to wait for another session. Could I ask you to thank our panellists, Behrouz Bouchani, Zaki Hadari, Adam Akamara and Zoe Holman. Thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.